Welcome to Appearance Matters, the podcast, the appearance psychology podcast brought to you by the Centre for Appearance Research, a world-leading research centre based at the University of the West of England in Bristol, investigating everything related to the psychology of how we look. I'm Maya.
And I'm Abby.
And today we have an episode focused on a very exciting programme of work at CAR called the CARE Project.
Yes, and CARE stands for Craniofacial Microsomia Accelerating Research and Education.
Yep, that's right. So you'll hear more about this from our guests, but overall, the aim of the CARE Project is to investigate the psychosocial impact and healthcare burden of a condition called craniofacial microsomia, which is a congenital condition that affects the development of various areas of the skull and the face.
And this programme of work is carried out by colleagues at CAR in collaboration with Seattle Children's Hospital, a team of multidisciplinary researchers, clinicians and advocacy groups based all over the world.
Yes, and I was joined by several members of this great team for the episode today. We have Dr. Nicola Stock, who is an associate professor at CAR, Dr. Alessia Johns, who is a paediatric psychologist at Children's Hospital Los Angeles, Laysa Schaefer, who is a patient advocate on the CARE Project, and Amy Schaefer, who is a parent advocate on the CARE Project and also Laysa's mum.
An excellent guest list for today's episode. Really looking forward to hearing more about the project. Let's hear what they had to say.
Welcome everybody to Appearance Matters, the podcast. It's really lovely to have you all here today to be talking about this exciting project. So I'm going to get started with our questions today. So Alessia, if I come to you first, it would be great to start out just by getting a bit of a background on the condition you've been working with. I wonder if you could tell us a bit more about craniofacial microsomia, please.
Of course. And so I'm Dr. Alessia Johns, and I'm a pediatric psychologist at Children's Hospital Los Angeles. And I've been working in the craniofacial team since 2007. So I'll let you all do the math on that. I've given up doing it myself, so it's easier to start off with the year. And during that time, I've had the pleasure of working with many families who have a child with craniofacial microsomia, which is sort of an umbrella term that covers a lot of different diagnoses that can be called hemifacial microsomia, can be also known just simply as microtia, or Goldenhar syndrome, or OAVS, which is oculoauricular vertebral spectrum. So all of these things fall under this sort of umbrella term that's being understood more in the medical field as craniofacial microsomia, or CFM for short. And it most often impacts the development of the ears and jaw, as well as the facial tissue, nerves. It can also impact eyes, spine, kidneys, airway. Some people also have a cleft palate. It can impact dental position. Many other aspects of health can also be part of this. And it's more the visible aspects and thinking from a CAR perspective. The more visible aspects more likely are going to be the development of the ear and jaw, which can be sort of a smaller ear to an absent ear. The jaw can be slightly smaller to quite a bit smaller to absent on one or both sides of the face, and then that can impact symmetry of the face and appearance as well. And then there can be other visible interventions, such as if someone requires a tracheostomy, or if they may have like a G-tube or other things like that may be part of their CFM health care as well.
Thanks so much, Alessia. That was a really fantastic kind of overview for us. And can you tell us anything more about what to like the day-to-day impact of living with craniofacial microsomia might be?
Sure. So, I mean, the daily impact of CFM varies so much on how it's presented. So it can be, I think, the most common aspect across the range of CFM is going to be hearing, which is, of course, crucial from infancy. And so intervention for hearing and having hearing aids in place and making sure that that's addressed appropriately is huge for all aspects of development. And then as people get older, of course, being able to hear to know where sounds are coming from, in addition to language and all the social interactions. So I think that's one of the more crucial things. But it can also be just having that sort of slightly smaller side of your face on one side versus the other can also sort of lead to people having sort of questions or responding in a little different way socially. And that's another sort of day-to-day aspect. But it really depends on what's going on medically, because if you're worried about airway or feeding or just sort of those basic things of getting through the day, then that can often be the focus of how it's impacting one. The other thing I should mention, no matter what, are lots of frequent medical visits. So regardless of what's happening, there are many, many visits and also quite a few surgeries along the way. And so I think that's another huge aspect that can get overlooked sometimes.
Thanks so much, Alessia. There's a lot that you've covered there, and all really interesting and important to consider. We're also joined today by Amy and Aleza, a parent advocate and patient advocate, and they're going to tell us a little bit about their experiences. So, Amy, if it's all right, if I come to you first, can you tell us a bit about your experiences of being a parent of a child with craniofacial microsomia, please?
I'm Amy Sheffer. I'm the mom of Laser Sheffer, who's now 20. Laser was born missing a substantial part of their jaw. And also, the jaw that was there was super tiny. So immediately needed a tracheostomy tube. And quite shortly thereafter, at the very beginning, to get any mama's milk at all, Laser needed an NG tube, which is a tube that goes up the nose and into the stomach, and that was replaced in short order by a gastrostomy tube. So some of the very initial moments of life were at the NICU for quite some time, trying to breastfeed and not being successful because mechanically there was no way Laser could latch. So a lot of the families that have kids with a more pronounced craniofacial microsomia, because it is a spectrum disorder. So, and I don't like the word disorder, but anyway, it's on a spectrum. And so people that are further along on the spectrum have much more medical intervention. So as a mom, we were in a small city, and nobody had seen anyone like Laser before. The NICU doctor stayed up all night trying to figure out what on earth he was looking at. Then we were shipped off to the main city of that state. Then we were at the main hospital in the state, and they had seen very few cases. First of all, we got a diagnosis quickly, which is good if you have a rare condition. Sometimes it's hard to get a diagnosis. Nevertheless, they hadn't seen such a pronounced case. So, you know, from the medical end, we had many more difficult navigations to make. Like, they couldn't assess Laser's hearing because they couldn't get a little bit that was small enough to go into the slit of the ear canal that wasn't really on the side that does hear, and then there wasn't a canal on the other side. So the logistics and the lack of familiarity required a lot more advocacy on my part, meaning refer us out. No, 2 months won't do, that kind of thing. And who else can I speak to about this immediately, et cetera. I guess to go back to your general question, since we had a more impacted first number of years, that meant much more intensive when you have a child that does not suckle. They also don't swallow. Swallowing is a precursor to speech. Then you have to, there's a lot of things to do to be able to, and speech is a precursor to literacy and reading and all that stuff. So as a teacher, I did a lot of stuff on the front end to make sure that the mechanical things didn't bleed over into expression, you know, delayed expression. So we learned sign language. My husband and I both learned sign language. Laser could speak to us in sign language and was always a very articulate person from super early age. So there were just a lot more things to have all systems functioning. We had to patch the eye that has a keyhole eye, different things like that. So very intensive first number of years, and then quite a number of surgeries so that Laser could be speaking before kindergarten. That's what we were aiming for, if possible, speaking by mouth so that Laser could be understood by a larger cohort than just mom and dad. We did have Laser in a preschool that did sign for a little while, but they booted Laser out because a speaking deficit doesn't qualify as the right kind of deficit to be in a special classroom, which was another opportunity for me to advocate loudly.
Thank you so much, Amy, for sharing all of your experiences and some of the early challenges that you had as a parent, kind of navigating different systems. And I, you know, particularly your reflections about kind of how care is for rare conditions in kind of systems that aren't always set up for that, and how you kind of took on a role as an advocate and kind of educator as well. So that's, you know, that was really fantastic to hear. Could you tell us a little bit about some of the positive aspects of your kind of parenting journey as well?
Well, we had a really great community around us that it sort of functioned like an extended family, and that was so wonderful. So we, I had been an educator for many years already, and we had the great, great fortune of having a really experienced home care nurse. I think it was never lost on us the radiant, happy child that we had. And Laser, for example, loved swimming and water. So despite my own fear, because trachs are a big deal, we would drag Laser around in the water and make as if Laser was swimming, and Laser was quite thrilled about that. And then, you know, I'd go, you know, behind the house and go afterwards. But we had plenty of really sweet times and such loving support around us. And it makes a difference. You know, you get a lot of reactions in public that are not friendly or like scared, or they see a trach or they hear that breathing from a trach and they're freaked out. So to have a core group around us that constantly was showering us in love and affection was really important.
That was really lovely, and thank you for your reflections on community. I know that lots of parents and individuals who kind of experience kind of living with a rare condition have also said similar things about that importance of having people around you who kind of understand and who are empathetic and loving and kind of drawing on your community and your village in that way. And that's interesting that you were kind of saying you had that balance of kind of wanting to give Laser that experience of being in the water, but yourself being quite afraid and trying to balance that kind of parent wanting them to have a you know, an exciting and enjoyable experience in childhood, but also balancing the fear. I can really see that, and thank you for sharing that. So if it's right, if I come to you, Laser, now, and can you tell us a little bit about your lived experience of Goldenhaar syndrome, and what has it been like for you growing up with this condition?
Well, I have lived now 20 years with Goldenhaar, and it was, I think, a much bigger part of my life when I was younger, because that's when a lot of the core, like, experiences of having a lot of surgeries, having a very, my face was a lot more noticeably different back when I was younger. And so I got a lot more stares or negative reactions out in public. And so I'd say it affected me a lot as a kid. And still to this day, I have like functionality things, like I'm blind in my left eye, deaf in my left ear. And even like eating so far is still a little bit challenging, even though I'm I think I'm close to how someone without a different mouth would eat. I still am just a bit slower. But growing up, my biggest thing with growing up while living with Golden Heart was having trying to interact with my peers. And I was lucky when I was younger, I went to a school that had the same class and the same teacher for grade 1 till grade 5. So I had my group of classmates, and they were they stayed pretty much the same for the 4 years while I was there. And that allowed me to kind of develop a close relationship with, you know, that core group of students. I think that was really helpful, because after I transferred out of there and had to go to a whole new school for a bit, I ran into a lot more of the like questions or negative reactions of people who honestly would probably just be curious, and they just don't know how to approach it a lot of the time. Or occasionally you did have the very rude comment. Another big aspect for me was, of course, all the doctor's appointments and the surgeries. And I mean, I don't really know how to explain it as much as I think it's really warranted. But with the multiple surgeries that I have had, one of the biggest factors for me is like just about going under. The minutes before you have the IV, you know, take you into dreamland, I honestly have had a hard time with that myself, with the anticipation, I guess, is what it is, and the moments leading up before it. And then afterwards, I always heal well and stuff. But over the last, like, as I've gotten older, I've found ways that I can prepare myself and have the best like experience possible. And so that has come down to advocating for myself and going into the surgery room. And I noticed that as I've gotten older and come kind of into adulthood, the adult hospitals that I've gone to have been less up for accommodating. And I think they're just not used to people asking. But the other thing for me is I also am autistic, so I have sensory things as well. So there's kind of a double whammy that happens sometimes.
Thank you so much, Laser, for sharing your experiences with us and kind of reflecting on some of your school experiences. It sounds like you had a really tight-knit group that kind of followed you through for a little while, and also reflecting on some of the things you discussed there in kind of medical settings, which must have been really difficult experiences, and how you've kind of come to navigate those and advocate for yourself as well. I was wondering whether you had any reflections on kind of any positive experiences of living with Golden Heart Syndrome.
I'd say one of the like greatest challenges, but on the flip side is also a great positive, is learning to just love yourself no matter what. And it's something that I'm still working on, honestly. But I actually was like, I had a really horrific experience when I was in second grade at my school, where a 4-year-old came up to me, and I was playing in the sandbox. She came up to me and said, "No one likes you, you know," and then threatened to snatch my hearing aid off my head and throw it into the road. And for those of you who don't know, hearing aids are really, really expensive. Well, as my mom did, just raising me to be self-sufficient and still enjoy doing rough and tumble activities outside, money was tight, and so it was kind of drilled into me how important keeping a hearing aid was. And so essentially I snatched the hearing aid back from her, told her to go away, and then I ran off. She ended up chasing me and then doing like a flying kick into my back while running. Then I ran to the teacher sobbing, and I didn't really know what to say, but I was just standing there crying. Long story short, that was my like one really big experience being bullied, I could say. So throughout the years after that, I became very hyper aware of how different I was. And that became one of the biggest challenges for me. For when I was probably between 12 and 16, I had a very big phase of not wanting to stand out in any way. I just want to blend in with everything around me just so I wouldn't be noticed. And then as I got older, and I've kind of grown up more, that's been one of the gifts that has come from that difficult time for me, has been learning to appreciate myself and my body, even if it doesn't look what others would consider normal. For example, I really love my eyes, I love my lips, and finding beautiful aspects of myself, even if sometimes the outer world doesn't quite see it the same way I do. So I think that's one of the biggest gifts I've gotten from living with Golden Heart, and also learning to stand up for myself. And again, it's something I'm still learning, but learning to advocate for what I need. And so those are some of the things I've learned and I think are positives with living with Golden Heart.
Thank you so much, Laser, and thank you for sharing what must have been a really difficult story with us, and kind of reflecting on that with us. And it's, you know, it sounds really, really scary, and it's lovely that you've been able to now reflect on what must have been really difficult and take something so positive from that, and kind of explain to us the way that it's kind of given you these positive outlooks on life and attitudes towards yourself as well. That's really fantastic. Thank you for sharing that with us.
You know, I think I have something to add there, because, you know, every person is born so unique and beautifully endowed with qualities that are just shine through from their very earliest ages. And I think it's really important to say that, like, Laser, when I say Laser was always a communicator, this was literally from infancy. Like, if you were approaching the bed and Laser was resting, Laser was like, not now. Or, yes, please do come over and cuddle me. No, take me over here. And a lot of the beauty of a human being is right there. And so clear that we could make decisions. Like, we decided we want a second referral because one surgeon said we won't do surgeries till 6 and Laser will not have a chance to communicate and be understood until that age verbally. And we're like, not acceptable. This person must communicate. This is like one of the central beautiful things about Laser. So even when there's a really profound difference, you would think that it obliterates everything. No, not at all. So as a parent, you still can cultivate all the gorgeous uniqueness of this person.
Thank you, Amy. Thank you for adding that. And I love the what you just said there about kind of the whole unique person. And I do a lot of work with parents of children with lots of different conditions, and one of the things that I and the parents often talk about is how their children tell their stories of who they are with their condition in mind, but also all of the other amazing, unique, wonderful things about who they are. And I feel like you've just really embodied that in your response there, so thank you. So we're gonna move on now to be talking about some researchy stuff. So Nicola, I'm going to come over to you now. So CARE is a big program of work which is currently ongoing at CAR. Could you tell us about the research that's happening as part of this program of work, please?
Yeah, of course. So just to introduce myself, I'm Dr. Nicola Stock, and I'm an Associate Professor of Psychology at the Centre for Appearance Research, and I'm also the co-principal investigator of the CARE programme. So the CARE program is funded by the National Institutes for Health in the USA, initially for a period of 5 years, although we do plan on sticking around for a lot longer than that. We have two main sites, one in Seattle in the USA, which is managed by my co-principal investigator, Professor Carrie Heike, and the second is managed by me at the Centre for Appearance Research. And we are a very large international team. So there's around 20 of us in total representing different areas of expertise from about 7 different countries. But we all share the same mission, which is to learn about the lived experiences of the craniofacial microsomia community with the aim of improving well-being and making a lasting difference to the CFM journey, both now and long into the future. The CARE study has 4 main aims, and I'm pleased to share that we have now completed the first aim, which was to carry out interviews with English and Spanish speaking young people and adults with CFM, as well as their caregivers, and to use those stories to build a conceptual framework, or in other words, a comprehensive overview of the various ups and downs of the CFM journey. So we interviewed over 100 participants. We asked them to divide their CFM story into chapters as if it were a book. And they gave each chapter a title and then described each chapter in detail. Also identifying high points, so particularly positive memories, and low points, particularly difficult memories along the way. Participants also shared with us how their care experiences could have been improved, as well as their priorities for future research. Now that we know what the CFM journey looks like from the perspective of individuals and families, we've been able to identify the areas where more information and support is needed. The second aim of the CARE program is to look at the psychological well-being of individuals with CFM and their caregivers in comparison to the general population. We'll also look at various factors which may put people at risk of or protect them from experiencing psychological distress. And the idea behind this aim is to learn how to identify people who may benefit from a little bit more support. So we've developed an online survey, which is currently open and collecting data from adults with CFM and caregivers of children with CFM from 5 countries. And that includes the USA, the UK, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. The third aim involves interviewing health providers and advocacy leaders from the USA about how they are currently addressing the information and support needs that we have identified through our Aim 1 interviews with individuals and caregivers. How good is the current healthcare system at supporting people's emotional well-being alongside their medical needs? How could the treatment pathway be improved? And what are the barriers and opportunities for doing so? Interviews for this aim are underway, and we're hoping to interview professionals with a wide range of medical backgrounds and expertise. The learning from the first 3 aims of the CARE programme will give us a clear direction on where we should focus our future research efforts to improve the CARE pathway so that we can make a real difference to the lives of people living with CFM. And finally, the fourth aim of the CARE programme is to build an international community of people who are interested in CFM research. Whether you're someone with CFM, a caregiver or family member of someone with CFM, a health professional, a researcher, or a member of an advocacy group, CFM is a rare condition. So we need to bring as many people as possible together to advance CFM research and improve the medical experience.
Thank you so much, Nicola. There is so much there, so much incredible and impactful work going on. And so thank you so much for talking us through all of that. And I'll come back to you in a moment when we talk about kind of what's going to happen next with this project. So I'm coming back to Amy and Laser with another quick question. So now that we've heard about what's kind of been going on with the CARE program, from your perspectives, can you tell us why you feel research into craniofacial microsomia is so important?
Well, I think research into Golden Heart or CFM is really important on a few different aspects. But one of the biggest things that I think research and learning more about the impact of having CFM and like even where it comes from. A couple of the bigger reasons that I think it's really helpful is learning how to give your child or yourself, if you're older, the best experience possible while growing up with CFM, or also learning, teaching like doctors and other people around you like more about what it is, and having more just awareness in general would be really helpful in the cases of sharing accommodations with your doctors or sharing accommodations with your school. If you, like, I know since I'm blind and deaf in one side of my head, I had to sit at the very top in front of the class to be able to read the board and hear the teacher. Having just general more awareness.
Thank you so much, Laser. And Amy, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, well, I have been a really passionate supporter of getting the word out there. There's very little, I mean, even when Laser was younger, you were saying stuff like, why don't they even know where this came from? And like, why are they calling it, you know, hemifacial microsomia? It's golden hair. Now cut it out. Like, it's really an odd experience because right now there is a hair breadth of information available about what caused, you know, CFM, what could anybody do, especially how you can find the resources you need. It's just not out there. It's not out there in the medical community. When you're in a situation of anything that is a strong medical experience, that's who you need to deliver you the information first. But over the, now that Laser's 20, you know, when Laser was a baby, there was no internet pretty much. I mean, I looked up stuff and there were a few paragraphs on what is golden hair, but now there's Facebook groups and there is a vast gulf in the information available in like golden hair chat groups and generally available to doctors. And if you're with a team that has no familiarity, you might actually get more information by talking to parents in a golden hair group and bring it back to your docs and then collaboratively guide the next steps. However, in the social media world, people are giving each other advice and they've never even seen your kid and they don't have a medical degree. Like, no, don't get this surgery, or yes, do. And that is like really scary. So there is a vast gulf where information is needed, solid information, and it needs to be contextualized well, especially because since this is a spectrum and you know, like in these golden hair groups, like a caregiver might answer that you don't really need to worry about jaw surgery until you're much older. And that's because that was what was true in their very different anatomical case of what this illness is. And that person, as long as people understand, that person shouldn't be speaking to somebody that, the parent of somebody that's missing half of their jaw. They have no idea how to answer. So any study about craniofacial microsomia is extremely important. And the impact of that study is much more right now because the CARE Project is one of the very first published studies that anybody could access. And I'm super passionate about getting all this stuff into parents' hands so that people who are in the position I was in have both their local team's assessment, some idea of how much their local team may or may not be capacitated to deal with their kid with their situation, so that if they need to move out of that situation, they can. What the research says and what parents say and how it all fits together. There's big gaps, and I just think it's so exciting that we have this ability to put actual information out there that is contextualized and usable. And having made it through all of this gauntlet of surgeries and many more profound challenges, we are now both cruising into the thriving zone of things. So I have started a business called Advocate Angels, and I am just more formalizing what I've done all along, which is being a bit of a Sherpa for families who may not have the help that they need. We're all totally blindsided in the first moments and not knowing what to do and how to navigate. So I'm all about bringing more resource to families, and I'm really excited for the publications we're doing that will be presented in the professional realm, but also in having them available to families and finding ways for families to connect and share the strength that they have with more resource than they currently do. I have been recruited to be part of the CARE Project along with another parent advocate. And this is a really awesome thing about this project and a new wave in medicine, where they are bringing aboard family members of people impacted by the thing that's being studied. So I just think this is an awesome thing, because we have a special eye towards getting the info out to our people in our community. And one of the phases of the study that we would like to get more funding for is called a registry. We had initially a little bit of funding to get it set up, but a registry is really important for rare conditions. The reason that research is lacking in many rare conditions is the logistics of flying everybody to Hoboken to interview them when they're all over the world, the money, that, you know, just amassing enough people to make it valuable to study. And the constraints of doing that in the past have been so big that it's just been very hard to pull off. The last part of the CARE study is establishing a registry. And what a registry is a collection of data across more countries. This has largely been made possible by Zoom and other ways to meet and hold the quality of gathering data. So I'm really interested in and hopeful that we can get more funding to establish. We established the basic catch basket for the registry, but if we're able to extend this kind of study across time, we will amass much more data and have it available to medical practitioners, and they will be able to run queries for their own studies, because there will be a pool of data, which has been such a hard thing to get.
Around what my mom was saying regarding what the cause is of golden hair, that's always something that's been intriguing to me. And so I'm hoping that with more research and more awareness of what you guys are doing, that possibly something might be found. But and then even without that, I like now that there's more of a consistent naming basis that golden hair has. Because whenever I went to go look up what golden hair syndrome is, I would get five different answers of all of the different names for golden hair, and each definition is really close to what I have, or it's not, or they have it under several different names, and so. That also leads to a lot of information potentially being left out, because even if you have all of the basic data on one thing, each of the different specialties, I learned recently that the ophthalmology things has a special section of their curriculum that goes over briefly what golden hair syndrome is from their specialty, right? And a lot of, I don't think all the doctors know that there are like five different names for what Golden Heart is. So they could be potentially missing out on a lot of good info. And I even learned stuff about myself more recently because I've like started looking up all of the other different terms. And so I think what's really great is that with the study that you guys are doing, and hopefully that registry will bring a lot of good information, and you can look at all of the info you need in one place.
Yeah, and you know, to add to that, this impacts the families quite a bit too. I recently did a YouTube video that's called What's in a Name, and I listed out all the names because I was in the chat, Golden Har UK, and there was a person in another chat in the UK that didn't know that the Golden Har UK chat was happening, and they were called something else. And I said, you know, so like, among parents, you can go looking for your group, and you're going to put in the group, the name that the doctor gave you. The doctor may have never seen anything. They're just looking on the internet also, you know. Mm-hmm. So you might artificially think there's only three people to talk to when there's actually hemifacial microsomia groups, microtia groups, there's Golden Heart groups, CFM groups. And you might even be in the same city with somebody who's talking in another group, or your doctor may have not told you this is a spectrum. Mm-hmm. So they might, you know, if you type something into the internet, it might say every possible thing. And you don't know that your child doesn't necessarily have vertebral anomalies and, you know, kidney or whatever. And you can easily get terrified. And because nobody has yet identified where on the spectrum your child is. So again, the information, just having more quality information and relevant expression to the families of what applies to each family.
Yeah, that's really
fantastic. We never had that.
No, and it's really fantastic to kind of hear your reflections on that, and how in some ways it's wonderful to have these resources online like support groups and Facebook groups, but in other ways it can almost be a little bit double-edged, in that people are only speaking from their experience, and actually what you need is a kind of evidence-based informed clinical perspective as well. Yeah, no, that, and that actually brings us on really nicely to kind of come back to Alessia. So from your kind of clinical perspective, what difference do you think this research could make to practice? And, you know, are there any recommendations that we can already take from the findings?
Absolutely. As we've just heard, having the results be based on the detailed experiences of individuals and their families from their own perspectives is really invaluable clinically. And to have it be completely guided by what they have decided to share in their stories is so different from just us going as providers and saying, tell me about X, Y, and Z, because we're not aware of what we don't know. We have huge blind spots. And this way, families are able to say, hey, you aren't paying attention to this, this, or this. And that is huge to be able to guide practice. And I think that's one of the huge strengths of this project. So we've so far been able to come up with some very concrete recommendations for those healthcare providers who are interacting with families during the very beginning at the time of birth, and very specific things that they should be saying and doing, and resources and education, because that's a foundation that lays all the years to come. And so that's something we've been able to do. We've also already put together some recommendations for Spanish-speaking Latino families. As we heard, that's been part of our sample. I neglected to mention earlier, we do have a little bit of different patterns in who CFM affects. And so while, as we've heard, it's a rare diagnosis with estimations about 1 in 5,600 to about 1 in 26,000, there is definitely a range there. And we see some ethnicities have higher rates, and that includes people of Latinx or Latino heritage, Asian and Native American. And it's also a little bit higher in males as well. So that's a sort of another pattern that we see. But in any case, it was important for us to really give voice to the Spanish-speaking Latino populations. And as I'm in Los Angeles, that's mostly who we have here. So it was really great to have that be a focus. And so, like, for example, one of the recommendations that came out of that was oftentimes there would be language or hearing related issues because of CFM that providers or educators attributed to, oh, well, they're just learning English. We don't need to do anything. They're going to catch up. And then they're getting delays or not getting the appropriate intervention services because of their CFM or health needs. So, for example, that's a very concrete recommendation we were able to highlight. And then sort of on a larger scale, the framework that's been put together has been really helpful because it's going to guide clinicians across all these broad areas to assess for and to know, oh, gosh, I need to look into feeding. I wasn't thinking about that. Let me ask about that or whatever the comprehensive framework covers. It's a great foundation for providers to start interacting with families to make sure that they're not missing these blind spots that unfortunately were, I think, continue to exist, and we're going to keep trying to flesh them out as the study goes on.
Wow, that's really fantastic to hear those, like you say, those really concrete, tangible things that you can recommend as a result of research findings, and how hopefully practice might change to make it, more person-centered and kind of inclusive for all of the patients that you might see. So back to Nicola now. What is next for the CARE project? There's so much going on, but what's coming next?
Yes, so we're currently working on disseminating our findings from the first phase of the CARE program as widely as possible. As Alessia mentioned, that includes the framework itself, as well as looking in more detail at some of those common challenges that participants described and some that Alessia just mentioned, such as diagnosis, feeding and treatment decision making, to name a few. We'll be sharing these findings at various academic conferences, in academic journals, through our advocacy partners, as well as through the CARE website, our newsletters and our social media. And ultimately, we'll be translating all of this information into action and using what we are learning to address some of the challenges that Amy and Laser have raised here today. So if you are interested in the work of the CARE team, and if you missed out on taking part in AIM 1, please don't worry, because we are also actively recruiting to AIMs 2 and 3 of the CARE program right now. So if you are an adult with CFM or a caregiver and you're living in one of those five countries I mentioned, the USA, the UK, Canada, Australia or New Zealand, we would love for you to share your experiences with us via our online survey, which should take around half an hour of your time, depending, of course, on how much detail you'd like to share. And the easiest way for you to find information about the AIM 2 online survey and all of the different features of the CARE program is to visit our website, which is www.thecarestudy.org. Your story really does matter to us, and we are very committed to using the information that you give to improve care for CFM in the future. If you're a health provider or advocacy leader and you're based in the USA, we would love to book you in for an interview to learn about how you and your team are addressing the psychological needs of the individuals and families that you see, and how we may be able to work together to overcome any barriers to delivering comprehensive psychological support. If you don't fall into any of these categories or you aren't eligible for our current studies, please do get in touch with us anyway, as there will be many opportunities to join our community and take part in future work.
Sounds like the future of the project is very exciting, and great to hear that there are still loads of opportunities for people to get involved. And we can share the link to the website and the link to the survey also in the show notes, so people can go straight there and click if they want to take part. So thank you all so much for your contributions today and for sharing so much with us. I do have one final question, which is arguably the most important question. So we have a cake and coffee morning on a Thursday when we have our team meetings at CARE. And we normally will bring in a baked good or a treat of some kind for us all to share. So my question to you all is, if you were to come to our coffee morning, what cake or treat, doesn't have to be cake, would you bring and why? So I'm going to come to Alessia first.
It's such a sweet question. I would bring, I think, a bag of mixed donut holes so that you would have lots of variety. They're each bite size and you could try a little bit of everything.
Oh, that sounds really nice. That sounds wonderful. Please do come and bring donut holes. Amy and Laser, you're next.
Well, I am a great fan of lemon pound cake with that really delicious powdered sugar lemon drizzle that is just hardened just the littlest bit over the top. And I would love that.
And then if I were to bring a treat, I would just bring a bunch of chocolate chip cookies, some made to be a little more crispy and some made to be ooey gooey with a lot of good melty chocolate in the middle, because I like both ways, and that way anyone can choose whatever they like.
What a classic choice, and I love the fact that you've considered everyone's textural needs in your treat bringing.
laser answer.
Nicola, you're okay.
Yeah, well, I'm definitely craving cake now, and you guys are all welcome anytime if you find yourself in the UK. Well, I've been to my fair share of car coffee mornings now, let's say, so I do probably need to up my game and find some new inspiration. But I was thinking about something Easter inspired. So my favourite thing to make is brownies. So maybe I could infuse some brownies with some cream eggs or mini eggs or something like that.
This is shaping up to be a fantastic coffee morning. I think we should actually do this. Let's get all of this cake together. Thank you so much to everyone for joining us. It's been really wonderful to meet you all and to hear your experiences. And thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Amazing. There was so much there to cover, so much going on in the project, and also sounds like there's a lot more exciting work to come, which will have a real impact on the lives of individuals with craniofacial microsomia and their families too.
Yes, definitely. And we had so much to talk about, and I learned loads speaking to the team. And if anyone is interested in hearing more about the project or potentially getting involved in some of the work, all the information and the important links will be in the bio.
Great. So that's all we have time for today. As always, thank you for listening to Appearance Matters, the podcast. Please remember to share, subscribe, rate, and review. Until next time.
Bye.